Welcome to another episode of Undisciplined. Undisciplined is a collaboration between the African and African American Studies program at the University of Arkansas and KUAF.
We'll be bringing you some of the best of what's happening in academia, taking it outside of the ivory towers, connecting it to what's buzzing in popular culture, and give you our take.
Taking the undisciplined approach of Africana studies outside of the classroom, into the community, and onto the airwaves, we invite you to share in research, ideas, movements of scholars and students, and members of Africa and the diaspora. I am your host, Dr. Karee Banton.
And I'm your co-host, Dr. Carrie Nisia Connor.
Let's get undisciplined! Hello, guests. Hello, Carnies. Hello, everyone.
Summertime.
Oh, my goodness. I thought I would be out here frolicking for the summer.
Okay, sweating, yeah. Losing all my...
Wedding season, getting invites to vineyards and things like that.
In the hot sun. But, you know, at least people are getting married, so I can't complain.
Oh, yes.
I've been to my second wedding this season, so I'm very happy.
I have not been to a wedding yet, and I'm happy. Not to be invited, so I'm surprised how much, you know, still doing work and involvement in history, as you know, as scholars, there's this false sense that exists out there that faculty, you know, teachers get summer off.
No.
And that's far from the case. You spend summer, you know, I almost forgot what I was writing about.
I've been teaching summer school and I have to write.
What was I writing about? The archives? What about the archives? What was I trying to say? So revisiting that work and, of course, you know, administrative work. But we're happy to be back in our groove.
Yes, in the studio.
In the studio, in the stew, as the rappers say. Interviewing one of my favorite individuals from our history department. And, you know... I remember coming into the history, well, when I was about to apply for the job, you know, this person was one of the people that people are like, oh, yeah, who's great there? Ah, Elliot. And, you know, that was the first introduction to that name. And so I am so happy to... you know, to have a chance to talk to him today. So thank you, guests, for joining us for another episode. Today, our guest is Elliot West. Elliot comes from Texas. Oh, my God. Maybe I might be the only thing about you, Elliot. He's come from Texas, got his BA, his PhD from the University of Colorado in 1971. And he joined the U of A faculty in 1979.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness. And so he has written a number of books, as we'll talk about today. Award-winning books have been... an esteemed guest and featured on numerous awards and panels and well sought out books like The Way to the West. I love that title. Mm-hmm. All right. Which received the Western Heritage Award, The Contested Plains, of course. And of course, his most recent work. That was awarded, probably the most prestigious prize in history.
Wow.
Right? The Bancroft Prize. Yes, his most prestigious prize in history for his last book that recently came out. And he was on the shortlist for the Pulitzer.
Wow.
Okay, so we're talking about...
We're
men among giants.
Yes.
Okay.
Taking some of the glow. Know?
But I have to say something else also. Their faculty who they have done great work, they're distinguished, as Elliot is, a distinguished professor. They've won many prizes. But to me, my favorite thing about Elliot, he is the most pleasant, mm-hmm. nicest person. It's not like one of those things where it's like, what do somebody like about you? Oh, nice shirt. He has the chops, and he's also a very kind human being.
Yeah. You know what I mean? We're just chopping it up and having really great casual conversation. No big ego involved at all.
So, Elliot, on many fronts, you know, is just an all-around winner. Right. So we're happy to have the Bancroft Prize winner in our midst today, yeah. For his work Continental Reckoning, mm-hmm. and Pulitzer Prize finalists. Right. Mm-hmm. So, Elliot, thank you so much for joining the Undisciplined podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Generally, it's great to be here. My new friends and my good older friend, Curry, who is also an extraordinarily kind person. We instantly sort of bonded because she signs off her emails with a quote from Kurt Vonnegut.
Yes.
Saying that's the most important thing, is just be kind.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much.
It's not overrated. Kindness is not overrated.
Wonderful. But another thing that I was fascinated by, Elliot, just to kind of jump into it, it's like, as somebody who does Western history, growing up in Jamaica, I grew up on Westerns. Mm-hmm. People might be shocked about that. You know, I tell the story how one time when I was in school in Nashville, I was in a honky-tonk and white people came up to me and was like, they were concerned that I was lost.
Are you okay, man?
Are you okay? They literally said, "We love Real Housewives of Atlanta." And Usher.
Cultural relevance. We appreciate that.
And I wish I had the time then to kind of school them about how popular Westerns mm-hmm. and country music mm-hmm. is in Jamaica. But that is something that you've had to encounter as someone who is an expert on the West.
Absolutely. Western, whether they're movies or whether they're novels or art or music, yeah, mm. it's universal. It's universal. See it everywhere. In fact, students of popular culture will tell you that the United States has two great, or three really, great exports, cultural exports. There's the jazz, mm. Detective stories, and Westerns. Mm. All three of those started here. Mm-hmm. All have spread across the world and, of course, very much a part of now international, global popular culture. So it's a fascinating phenomenon. And, gosh, for many years now, well over close to 50 years, I've taught a course called The West of the Imagination, mm. which studies exactly that, the Western myth, this question that you're raising, why is it? What is it about it? It's such a universal appeal. And it's a very interesting topic. Although you got to always keep in mind that it's not Western history. What you see in movies and the sort of the sentiments that you hear in other forms, that's not the West that people create in their mind. Right, and that's a topic in itself. That's mm-hmm. fascinating, but it's not the story, you know, the real story. So my job as a student of the West is really both of those, study both of those.
Mm-hmm. Study the imagination and then study the real history.
That's right, what we might call the Western myth on the one hand and mm-hmm. the West of reality mm-hmm. On the other hand. Yeah.
So where did your fascination begin? I imagine it began with your name. You know, Dr. West is going to study the West.
Yeah.
But where did your fascination with Westerns beyond just the popular culture that made you seek deeper and want to understand the reality of the West?
Well, it's a story I've told many times. It did not begin with a name. It did not begin with a name. In fact, it was truly a couple of years out of grad school when mm. somebody pointed out, you know, your name is the same thing as the field.
I was on the right track there.
Never occurred to me. never occurred to me. But to get back to your question, my undergraduate work was not in history. Mm. It was in journalism. I come from a journalism family. My father was a very fine editor. My older brother is now retired, but he was a great journalist, far better writer than I am. So I was ready to go into that. I loved it, but also loved history. Mm. along the way. I loved growing up. I took more history courses than journalism courses as an undergraduate. Just loved it. Also loved Colorado. Now, if you grew up in Dallas, you know Texas, right?
Yes, shout out Texas.
If you can, you escape to Colorado during the summer.
Why?
It's hotter than hell. To cool off. And my grandmother had a house there, and my brothers and I would go there. And I loved it. Mm-hmm. Loved it. Loved the mountain, loved the Rockies, loved that area. So I thought, well, you know, if I like history and I like Colorado, how about applying to grad school in history in Colorado?
That so, trajectory is not normal.
No, it is not. As we both know, you know, through the years.
Yeah, people go to, where they want to study with the best
with
people.
With a particular
and all
person,
that,
it's a very, very sort of a choreographed, and well thought out. Mine was completely a whim. And they offered me this incredible fellowship. I said. So I figured it's probably a clerical error. So I said, sure, I'll do it.
Yeah, hurry up and sign before the dean changes his mind.
Right. Before they check the fine print. Yeah. Well, anyway, I showed up there, and the chair said, so what are you going to study? I said, history. He said, no, you got to focus on something. Mm-hmm. Right. I thought, oh, I mean, I honestly didn't know you had to specialize. Mm-hmm. So I came, my family's deep southern roots, Mississippi, Tennessee, South Carolina, Georgia. I loved southern history, so I said, okay, I'll do southern history. They said, nobody here does southern history. I went, oh. I said, what do you do? Well, we do a lot of the West. I said, okay, I'll do the West. So that's where it came from. Completely
serendipitous. We thought you were watching... You know, all these, you know, cowboy movies and going out there like, yeah, I want to know about John Wayne.
Right, yes.
No, well, like you, I grew up with, loved him, of course, growing up. Everybody did. But that wasn't it. It turned out to be part of what I studied, of course. But
So in a way, the topic kind of chose you.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
I love that. And I love in your story how you're hearing, you know, like you took a chance. You took an opportunity. You said yes, you know, and then it became something that you have become, you know, immensely great at.
it was completely luck. As Greek could tell you, as you know, people now going into grad school, you're very careful about who you choose. You go into it thinking about what your dissertation is going to be. You know, I just want to tell my students, you know, loosen up.
Yeah.
Right? Loosen up.
My story is similar to yours. I had no idea about what getting a PhD was going to entail, who I needed to choose, and what I needed to study. I just had the opportunity to come along, and I said yes, and I learned and failed as I went along.
That's right. That's right.
What was your favorite Western growing up? Like?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's changed, of course, over time. Growing up as a boy, you know, I loved the usual shoot 'em up, bang, bang stuff. over time, it changed as I understood the West better and as I studied Westerns in the popular culture. Right now and for years, my favorite Western has been, it's not the usual list, it's things like The Searchers, you know, My Darling Clementine, things like that. Mine is The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Okay. I've never heard of any of those.
Oh, gosh. Well, you're culture deprived.
Well, my parents, they love the Westerns. Like, my dad watches them on TV. My mom will watch them sometime. And recently we went to Kentucky, and my uncle had this belt set or this holster set. And so they went back to their old days of gunslinging.
Right.
And it was just interesting to watch them kind of like become these little boys again, but it hasn't at all been a part of like how I was raised. But yet in popular culture, you know, listening to Beyonce's new album, Cowboy Carter,
and
her mentioning of John Wayne, I'm like, ooh, who is this guy? And apparently he was kicking butt. Like, what show was he on? And maybe I need to watch it. And maybe I need to get more involved in the story of the West. So why do we need to remember the West? Why should it be a part of the American consciousness as well as our memory?
Well, that's a very important question. it's one I think it has basically two answers. The first answer, and I think the one that's more important of the two, has to do with this book that Curry mentioned, Continental Reckoning.
Powerful title. Powerful.
I didn't choose it, so I can take no credit for it. But if there's a single theme to that book, it is that while in the past historians have treated the West and Western history as this kind of exotic, peripheral story that's going on out there, it's going on out there, and it ends around the opening of the 20th century, the main theme of this book is you cannot possibly understand American history coast to coast, all of it, without giving the American West a very prominent place, close to center stage. In the middle of the 19th century, the period that I studied, in the second half of the 19th century, the usual event that everybody points to is the American Civil War, of course. That was the great event that made modern America. What I'm arguing in this book is that, of course, I don't know how you would go about overestimating the importance of the American Civil War. But what I'm arguing here is that the acquisition of the far west, the events that followed that, the development of its resources, the kind of challenges that were met going out there, all of that was as important in the long run as a Civil War in turning this country's history into what we would know as modern America, making the United States as we would know it in the 20th and in the 21st century. It was that important. So why study the West? That's start with that. You cannot possibly understand American history. You cannot, and that's of course another way of saying we cannot possibly understand ourselves unless we bring that prominently into the story. The second reason is going back to this idea of the Western myth and this fascination. Isn't that interesting? what is it, Cowboy Carter? Is that it?
Yeah.
what a great example of what Kareem was talking about. It's universal.
Yeah.
Why is that? When I'm to an extent argue this in the book, but in other things I've argued that point number one, Westerns are not about the West. That is, they are not about what was truly, but not Western history. Westerns are a reflection of what people in the United States and what people worldwide want the West to have been. It's not about Western history. It's what people want Western history to have been.
Okay.
And that's another way, especially in this country, that's another way of saying that Westerns reflect the particular attitudes and moods of any particular time. Our anxieties, our fears, our pride, our our sense of ourselves. Who are we?
Yeah.
We answer that question with Westerns.
Mm.
So in times of great pride, justified pride, like in the 1940s and 50s, where the United States is a key player in saving Western civilization, Westerns are very upbeat. The 40s and 50s, these are sort of the classic Westerns that express this great upbeat, this great prideful view of the United States.
Nationalism, it's contributing to nationalism and patriotism.
Of course, it's an expression of that. It cultivates that. Yeah, moving to the 60s, so we all know, and one I remember, 60s is a time of great criticism. Of the government. It was Vietnam. It was counterculture. It was all of a sudden. So all of a sudden, Westerns, the government becomes the villain. And and the people who are opposed by who are engaged by the government, they become the heroes. So in the 40s and 50s, Indians are the bad guys. 60s are the good guys. But that has nothing to do with what happened. It has to do with what we think about our society.
It's following the ethos of the time, the zeitgeist.
Exactly right.
Wow.
So that's what Westerns are. And that's why they're fascinating to study and important to study. So the question, why study Westerns? Why study the West and why study Westerns? They're two very different reasons. But they're important reasons, valid reasons. You can learn a lot. In both cases.
Wow. Now I'm going to put on a new lens if I ever start to actually pick up watching Westerns of the time period and what's happening and how is this a reflection of what people are thinking and feeling and experiencing. That's a very interesting lens.
I wanted to in terms of thinking about the relationship between American Indians and how they are portrayed and, you know, their lives that you study, and you're studying that distinction, you know, Wounded Knee recently we've seen, what's his name on those films? Was it Yellowstone?
Yes, oh, I was just going to bring that up. Yeah, yeah. Kevin Costner. Yeah. Yes.
What can you tell us about the lives of indigenous people, right? And the ways in which, you know, some of the films might, because I'm sure lots of students come to your class, they watch this film and they want to know about, you know, this great Cherokee warrior or whatever through this or whatever.
What boarding schools.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, gosh. Yeah, there's so many ways to answer that. And it's a very complicated situation because you have to track it over time, just as you have to track Westerns over time, because they change, they evolve over time. Mm. The image of Indians in them evolves as well as part of that. The first thing to remember, I think, in this larger story is that until the latter part of the 19th century, there was no such a thing as American Indians. Native peoples identified, they didn't identify as Indians. They identified tribally. You know, I'm a member of the Cherokee or the Choctaw or the Comanche or the Apaches or the Winnebago or the Tlingit. Or, you know, today there are more than, there are something like 530 federally recognized tribes in the United States. You know? And the people in those tribes, if you ask them, you know, who are you, they'll identify with that tribe.
Yeah.
You know, that's who I am.
Yeah.
They will also identify as American Indians, but that's a late phenomenon, and it's one that we imposed on them. You mentioned boarding schools. Think of what a boarding school was. This is one of the delicious ironies in this story. Boarding schools, of course, were places where Indian children, young people, were sent in order to convert them into American citizens. Yep, you were sort of unlearn who you were as an Indian and become an American.
Kill the savage, save the man.
Yeah. Give up your language. Dress the way you're supposed to dress. You know, adopt Christianity if you don't already have it. Be sort of transmogrified into this other people. In the famous phrase of a man named Pratt, Colonel Pratt, who started the Carlisle School, he said, "Our job is to kill the man to save the Indian." What he's saying is, our job is to kill, to stamp out, to suffocate your sense of Indianness, of being an Indian, so you can so we can save you as an American, right? The irony of course, that there was no sense of Indianness. it was tribal identity. So all of a sudden, you have all of these young folks from hundreds of tribes across the country, all different backgrounds, all different languages, all different cultures, all different cosmologies, all of this incredible mixture of people. Put them together in this one place, right? And they say, "Hey, oh, we're alike." We're all different, but we all are facing these same challenges. We're all facing this same challenge, this same problem, the government doing to us what we don't want it to do. It's out of that that they come to this sense of common identity that we call American Indians. So the boarding schools, which are designed to kill, as in Pratt's term, to kill American Indians, created American Indians. Classic example of a government setting out to do something and producing exactly the opposite, which is an old story.
So the way, I've never heard the quote as you said it, kill the American Indian.
No, well, kill the man.
Kill the man.
Is that right? Kill the Indian, that's right. Kill the Indian to save the man, that's right.
So was the way I taught in school just made up? Which was the derogatory term, savage, kill the savage, save the man? Was that just, or?
Sure, that's what he was saying.
Well, I know that's what he was saying, but I'm questioning why in school was I taught that specific phrase instead of saying kill the Indian, you know, kill the American Indian. And I'm not asking you to answer that question, but I'm just thinking now about the way that we were taught in history, that specific phrase versus how it was actually said.
I think they were just substituting a word that fits perfectly well in the context of for Pratt's phrase, but same idea. So he was saying by kill the Indian, he was talking about kill the savage in this person and turn it into a civilized person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, in terms of you know, the misrepresentations. And as you said, those are rampant, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of how the Indians, because their particular agenda, and maybe it would be good to have our audience understand the kinds of agenda, all the different groups of people who have come into the United States. There have been an agenda that the United States have, the enslaved Africans, you want their labor. Mm-hmm. For indigenous people, you want their land, right? You know, and how they're all these different groups of people are fitting into the United States, right? Especially, you know, as your area of expertise, that West, how that is all figuring into that American story.
Yeah, that's a really important question. It really fits in to the point I made earlier, that you cannot understand American history broadly, completely, without bringing the West more into it. Take the question of race and racism in the United States, the history of race and racism in the United States. We have come to, partly because of the domination of the Civil War in our thinking about that period, we've come to think of that question pretty much in binary terms. You know, when you're talking about race and racism, you're talking about black and white. Right? Well, bring the West into it. All of a sudden, it looks much more complicated than that. American Indians are the best example of that. What about their treatment? How do they fit in? I was at a conference in England last year in Oxford, and there was a panel. It was on citizenship and acceptance in American history. The discussion was entirely about black and white, black history, entirely about that. Citizenship. When did Indians become citizens? The people who have been living here at least 16,000 years. Enslaved people got their freedom, in the 13th Amendment. They got their citizenship in the 14th Amendment. They got the right to vote in the 15th Amendment. American Indians officially received citizenship 56 years after freed people, 1924. Until 1924, Indians were not citizens. Acceptance, fitting in.
Because after the 14th Amendment, right, they were birthright citizenship.
No, because the legal tradition is that Indians are separate legal identities.
Yeah, I was going to ask, when did that begin, though?
Well, that goes back to the very beginning. It begins, of course, with the government recognizing that you are a sovereign people. Mm-hmm. And that made sense in 1650, because they were their own nation, they had their own government, their own power, they were powerful people, right? So we're recognizing units like France, you know, being in Tennessee.
Right? Yeah.
So, but as time passes, and as, you know, the white majority becomes the majority, then the supermajority, then the super majority, and then they take over, that becomes a hindrance. All of a sudden, we're controlling you. But you're not citizens.
Mm-hmm.
But you have no rights as citizens. You have no rights under the Constitution. You have nothing under the Bill of Rights, right? Because you're not an American citizen.
Mm-hmm.
You're recognized as somebody different. So up until 1924, they had none of those rights.
Mm-hmm.
1924. Until, as far as acceptance and membership in the American family, the government policy from the outset was that its goal was to do everything it could to require Native peoples to surrender their culture, to surrender their language, to surrender their sense of family, to their systems of family, to surrender their sense of land ownership, to surrender their cosmologies and their religions and their beliefs, all of that. You know, give up your culture.
Right.
Then you can fit in. Then you can fit in. So in terms, that didn't change until 10 years after they got citizenship. Only in 1934, under the New Deal, did the government officially, formally reverse its policy and say, okay, now you can be your own people. So while African Americans received their freedom and their citizenship and freedom in the 1860s, it was 1920s and 30s before any. So that's, of course, I hope, people understand that I'm in no way downplaying, the nightmare of the black experience in this country. What I'm saying is these questions of race and racism are continental. They include Indians. They include Hispanos. They include Asians. The Chinese are the only people in our history who have been excluded from coming into admitting into the United States strictly on the basis of her ethnicity. That's a Western story. Right? So it's only then. So put it another way, Van Woodward's famous classic book, The Burden of Southern History. Race is the burden of Southern history. Race is the burden of American history.
Right.
This is an American, coast-to-coast, multi-ethnic story, and that's what I mean when I say until you bring the West in,
you can't get those
you
stories.
You won't get that. You won't get it.
Yeah,
and the story gets much messier when you do that because when during those years when African Americans were given their freedom, citizenship, very limited citizenship,
right.
And poorly executed citizenship,
yes.
The vote, although. Not really. for a lot of when we took these huge steps toward that for African Americans, those are the same years in which Indian peoples were being confined to reservations. Their land was taken away from them. Their freedom was taken away from them. It's a messy story. The emancipation of enslaved peoples was a moral high point in our history. That same period, we're doing the opposite.
There's so much immorality still happening, when westward expansion, you have Louisiana Purchase, you have the mestizos, the mulattoes, you have the integration of those peoples, you have the Mexican-American War and the integration of, a new Hispanic Chicano and Tejano culture, and then, the Japanese internment and, the gold rush. And so, and even... the invitation that the Irish received into the nation. When you're thinking about these stories in westward expansion, you're really thinking through historical phenomena, how these different groups of people have been invited to receive
That's
citizenship
right.
in this country.
That's right. It's a much, much larger story. It's a much messier story.
Yes.
But it's a lot closer to the truth.
So your big book, the prize-winning recent book, Continental Reckoning. Tell us, how did you come to that title? When I looked at it, I was like, this has something to do with historiographical consensus about
historiographical consensus.
Does that mean? That's a big term.
That means historians agreeing on something which never happens.
Yeah, historians have agreed. Like it has settled into a knowledge. It's almost like it has become fact. Right? Because enough people has agreed on it. And we could query that, right? In terms of what stories goes into that consensus or helps to shape or inform that consensus, right? But you're trying to unravel that, right? American history, right? This. How did you come to the title, and then what were you trying to do in this work?
Okay. The title, I am the worst at using titles, whether it's for
hire me. I'm really good at that.
Oh, yeah, we're rivals. I bet I beat you. But
you got to make it a title that is searchable. That's what I learned.
That's true. I mean, I've written what 8 or 9 books now, and every time they came up with a title, it said, "Nah, don't do that." So, and this was no exception. Press came up with, University of Nebraska Press came up with. I think it's a good title. Mm-hmm. It's a little, you look at it and you scratch your head a little bit, but that, of course, that's the point.
Yeah.
As you just said, Karee, what do you mean with that?
Continental reckoning.
Okay. Well, it means, in my opinion, continental. The point I was making earlier, mm-hmm. we cannot understand what was going on at the time, and we cannot understand the consequences of that unless we think all the way across the continent, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. You got to bring in the whole story. You got to pull back to this, you know, a wider angle lens as you got on mm-hmm. your camera. Reckoning. The point there is, we got to rethink it.
Yeah.
Right? We got to reckon with
it. You got to talk about it, first of all.
That's right. Yeah, right. Describe it, and then ask, what does it mean?
Yeah.
What's this? How do we reckon this? And what I'm trying to do here is to force us to reckon with it, mm-hmm. to rethink it, to, you know, the term revisionist is, for some mm-hmm. reason, kind of a pejorative. Mm-hmm. That's what historians are supposed to do. You know, they're supposed to rethink. Vise in revision comes mm-hmm. from seeing, right? A vision. So to revise is to look again.
Yeah.
Right. You look again. So let's look again. Let's keep it coast to coast, and let's look at it hard again. Ask some questions and try to think. How does the story change? Mm-hmm. How does this narrative change? How does the consensus get unconsensus? Right? Mm-hmm. How do we pick it apart? That was the hope of it.
What were the things that you were pushing back against specifically? What were the lines of arguments, the unsettled debates that you were pushing against or trying to bring forward or integrate as you were putting this work together?
Basically, well, 2 or 3 ways to answer that. Excuse me. As I mentioned before, in a lot of ways, this period, the period I'm writing about, which is roughly 1850 to 1880 or maybe a little later, you know, those 30 years, when historians have written about that, and more important, when they have thought about that in terms of how we fit this into the larger narrative of our country, the Civil War dominates everything. You know, it's like this historiographic black hole. It just mm-hmm. sucks everything
between
else into
that
it.
Time period. Yeah.
When
I think about my education and my the curriculum, what I learned, you're right. It went from, the Louisiana Purchase right to the Civil War.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the Civil War explains what all followed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, no, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't. Mm-hmm. It does not tell the whole story. It's a critically important part of that story. We're drawn to it for all kinds of different reasons. It's very dramatic. Yeah, there's a lot of heroism in it. It ends on a positive note, right? Yeah. Union wins, right?
It's gilded. gilded positive note.
Well, that's right. We look back and we see all kinds of limitations. But you know, the Union won. The Republic survived. Mm-hmm. Slaves, enslaved people were freed. Okay, that's all good, right? Mm-hmm. And then, for Pete's sake, you know, the great mm-hmm. central tragic figure of it, the president, dies on Good Friday. I mean, give me a break. that's quite a story.
Poetic.
Yeah, it's a perfectly scripted, story. Yeah.
So what other stories?
When you go out west, you know, and all this other stuff is happening, you know, but it's happening all over the place. Mm-hmm. Very, very different developments, all happening fast, mm-hmm. all creating huge changes, mm-hmm. all of them interrelated, all of them at the same time, and it's like chaos. There is no structure to it.
Right? I can't help but
that's the West.
I can't help but think about the Children of the Flower Moon.
The what?
Yeah.
The
oh my God. Yeah. So good.
Children of the Flower Moon?
The
Flower Moon, the recent movie that came out
oh.
about.
Yes.
Killers
of the Flower Moon.
Killers of the Flower Moon. About the indigenous people and the oil.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
All that exploration of oil, and then all of a sudden you have all these people coming in to claim guardianship, and then they disappear. All these murders are happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And bringing in interracial relationships and love as a motive or way to
access. Way to get in there.
Yeah, get access. Oh,
that's
my God.
Right.
You got to be careful with your heart, y'all. Your heart and your pocketbook.
Sure, it's the same thing, right? That's true. And that's a great example of how these stories persist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that didn't come out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
That story, you know, that's set much later in the 20th century. That didn't come out of nowhere. That's an inheritance mm-hmm. of a story that goes before. And that's what I'm trying to get across here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically what I was trying to say in this.
Mm-hmm. So are the actors in this text primarily focused on natives, or are we seeing what other stories and histories are being brought into the continental reckoning?
Well, I try to bring as much as I can, and that's part of the reason that it's so difficult to get a handle on this, because there are so many actors,
mm-hmm. yeah.
so many people involved. Native peoples are a critical part of it.
Yeah.
And what I try to do in the book is I try to bring them in every chapter. If you look at histories of the West before this, quite often you'll find it'll give the usual story, and then at the very end they'll say oh and they're Indians,
mm-hmm.
and they'll bring that in as kind of a separate chapter, their own story. I think of that as kind of a textual reservation. It's like just like you put them on a reservation.
Yeah.
You're putting your story over here in a separate place.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's all tied up. It's all tied up in that larger story. So I try to bring it in that way. But this is not a history of Indian white relations, of native newcomer relations. It's mm-hmm. a history of. I try to bring it as much as I could. Over, 50 years of research. You got a lot of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got a lot of
so
notes.
Where is that data coming from? Is it coming from the voices of natives, or is it more those who are coming from the history canon?
What kind of archives are you looking at?
Yeah. Any place I could find.
Mm-hmm.
Getting the native voices, that's a tough gig.
Mm-hmm.
Because
as it should be.
it's hard.
Are they just a little bit like standoffish when
that's part of
researchers
it. That's
come
what,
in?
One of the things you learn very, very quickly when you are researching American Indian history and you go to interview and you go to talk to Native peoples themselves,
mm-hmm.
you know, they for perfectly good reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You've screwed up this story always in the past. Why mm-hmm. should I tell you anything? Mm-hmm. Plus, who are you to tell my story,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it your business?
Yeah, how can I trust you to do it?
That's right.
What lens can you ever present my truth? Yeah.
So what you have to do in the case, I've never been in the position to earn that trust long to live among Native peoples long enough
mm-hmm.
to get. So that's a reality. What I've done is to look in the archives as much as I can, and it's there.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. You can find those voices there.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. It's hard.
Mm.
A lot of that, what is not directly from their voice, is from what they're saying through white voices.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you got to
disaggregate.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be careful with that,
right?
Because
there's
they're hearing
reading.
They're hearing what they need to hear.
Right.
And they're saying their way of understanding it,
mm-hmm.
and that's not
always
necessarily what they're saying.
Yeah.
But once you get into that, you can got to speculate. You got to play with it. But it's there. It's critically important to do everything you can to bring those voices into it.
Mm-hmm.
Doing that is a tough job.
Yes.
But as I said, Native peoples were only some of the cast. I tried to bring in as many people as I could, and that's more accessible. But it's a big, boy.
That's a big job.
A lot of folks out there. Right?
How many pages is in this book?
It's a long book, right?
It has to be.
Yeah.
It has to be.
Yeah, it is.
Written like a Bible.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah, but I imagine, you know, just, I think, you know, I've wondered, you know, as I've I asked you about indigenous ways of knowing,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, often in my class, you know, as a Black person, I talk about Black ways of knowing. We often make fun online and say that our ancestors didn't leave behind, like, any specific measurements for recipe. We just, like, sprinkle until the ancestors tell us to stop.
Yeah.
Like, it's innate. It's intuitive,
uh-huh.
right? It's, you know, being around, like, if you grew up and you're in the woods, you can smell certain woods. You can, like, you know, you have a sense. Like, you know, I've always had this idea about indigenous people and fires, like, you know, mm-hmm. how they might even approach and use fire,
mm-hmm.
right? Might not be how other Western people approach and use fire.
Oh, it's absolutely true.
Right? And it can be particularly telling. You know,
sure.
So
sure.
Like, what kind of ways, indigenous ways of knowing, have you kind of worked with, and how do you kind of unpack that for your readers?
Yeah, there are a couple of ways to answer that. One, in terms of what you're talking about, for example, use of fire. Those have to do with by Native thinking. You're talking there about a custom, you know,
mm-hmm.
different customs, and that's a fascinating topic in itself. Fire is a great example,
mm-hmm.
How they thought about it, how they used it, how
mm-hmm.
they understood it,
mm-hmm.
how they controlled it. And that's true of many, many other things. Obviously, this enormous knowledge of plants, you know, and
mm-hmm.
of how they might be used and medicinally and so
right.
and eating them, you know, so many different ways. Their understanding of wildlife, you know, their understanding of these different animals that they were relying upon. There's extraordinary understanding. If you look at most of those in the West, were hunter-gatherer peoples. You know, they weren't farmers. Some were. To be a hunter-gatherer society, you had to have this profound knowledge of your environment,
mm-hmm.
of everything that was living in that environment. You had to know, if you're in California, you never know when are the salmon running? When does this kind of
mm-hmm.
salmon run? When does that kind of salmon run? When are the elk migrating?
Mm-hmm.
When does this bulb become edible and
mm-hmm.
not kill you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you use the bark of that tree?
Mm-hmm.
There's that sort of that custom. And thank goodness, at the time, in the 19th century at least, there was a great awareness of that among American researchers. The whole field of ethnology was born
mm-hmm.
during that period. What's interesting is one of the reasons the Bureau of Ethnology, for example, was created during these years, one of the reasons that it was created was to record these ways of life, these languages, these ways of life, these customs, this basket making, all of that, because, going back to what I said before, because the government's job
mm-hmm.
was to kill that.
Right.
To get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
We need to have a record of what it was.
Mm.
Right? So we'll record it and then we'll kill it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Of course, they didn't. One thing that's most impressive to me about Native peoples is their resilience, their adaptability,
mm-hmm.
their ways of working within new systems of power and authority to keep their culture,
mm-hmm.
to retain. Same thing with Black history, of course. The same thing, what you see in other cultures as well. You see it in Black history, you see it in Hispanic history, you see it in Chinese history. You know,
but none like the Native history and
like
Native
that, because
story. Because they're the way that they were invited to citizenship or sovereignty, you know, is different.
Right, that's right. And of course, their knowledge of this country was, you know, light years ahead of what the invaders were bringing to it. So that's all fascinating. The other way to answer that question, Karee, is a way of thinking is not so much by custom, but in terms of cosmology, of their understanding of nature as a spiritual force, their understanding of their place in this larger world.
I know that is paramount. Like, we could look at their protests for water. It's
mm-hmm.
It's completely antithetical to some of the Western. You live
yeah.
you live in harmony, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Everything
yes.
has energy,
it's
and it's contributing, and
mm-hmm.
you're just my, you know, you're just but one force.
Yeah.
Right. You don't understand that kind of in a hierarchical relationship in terms of I was here to have dominion over.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I am here alongside the rivers and the trees and the, you know, and if I don't take care of it, it will not take care of me.
That's exactly right. It's
it's very anti-capitalist.
It's an idea that's easy to romanticize and easy to overdo.
Yeah.
This whole idea of, oh, you know, they're living at one with nature and so forth.
Right.
But it's true.
Yeah.
It's not, it's hard to put it in words exactly, but there's that attitude. And it's likely held by the guy who's changing your tires at Walmart. You know, it's not. It doesn't mean you're living in this other reality.
Right.
It just means the way you look at the world is fundamentally different.
Yep.
From others.
I'm just going to take just enough because I don't want to destroy this thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas other people is like, well, I'm just going to take it all now, and no concern for whether it's going to be replenished.
I think
whatnot.
It's a consciousness of oppression.
Yeah.
Of how easy it is to be an oppressor, and also the consequences of oppression on the oppressor.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That said, part of his story, you got to say, it's a messy story. Mm-hmm. Part of the story includes Indian peoples themselves being caught up in this new reality.
Mm-hmm.
The classic example of that I've written about in different works is the decline of the American bison, the buffaloes.
Mm-hmm.
We think of that for very good reasons. It's primarily in terms of those white hide hunters, those guys who are going out there and killing 20 and 30 and 50 of them at a time. You know, that happened. But at the point that began to happen, the population was already had declined by maybe half.
Mm-hmm.
And many different reasons for that. But one reason was overhunting.
Yes,
in plains, peoples got caught up in this market economy, and they, whoa, you know, I can sell these hides, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy all sorts of stuff. Right?
Wow.
So they become, you know, caught up in the same system that in the end destroys them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of this messy, contradictory story that I'm trying to tell.
Wonderful.
So what would you say, what would you leave us with in terms of today, right now? What do we need to remember about the West as one cautionary tale or pearl of wisdom or something that takes us forward?
Yeah, well, I'm all out of pearls. I would say the point I've made a few times here today, study that history, because you cannot understand this country, you cannot understand yourself without bringing that story completely into it. The second point I would make is it's messy. Mm-hmm. You know, there are no simple answers to that. Mm-hmm. And part of that lesson is be careful.
Mm.
If there's one thing you could say about these pioneers going here, they thought they were in control. In some ways, they were. But in other ways, of course, they were not.
Mm-hmm.
And they were setting in motion changes and changes in some cases were good, and a lot of cases were turned out to be calamitous that they could not have foreseen. So be careful. Right? Study history. Study history and be careful.
Mm. Wonderful. Well,
period, Pooh.
Period. Thank you so very much, Dr. West.
Yes,
this has
thank you.
Elliot. this has certainly been a pleasure for you coming to the Undisciplined podcast and sharing your pearls of wisdom and years of being a history professor, distinguished history professor.
You still got
some. Oh, yeah. He's still you know, telling us, you know, or showing us the path that we should go. And even in the retirement, we're seeing how we can even, you know, move towards that end.
Personally, I think you should be a voice actor, like listening to your feedback here in the headphone. You should do an audio book of your book.
That's your
you
second
have a very
win.
Pleasant
well,
voice.
Last I heard, they were doing an audio version, and it's 700 pages long. So, I asked who's doing it, and I got his name, and I sent him several boxes of throat lozenges.
Well, we're so happy, you know, that you've shared your pearl of wisdoms with us, and thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. Great time, a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, family, until next time.
All right.